In September of 1779, there was a fight brewing in Savannah. British forces, more than 3,000 of them, were under the command of Major General Augustin Prevost, who was reluctantly put in charge after the capture of British General George Garth. On the Patriot side, General Benjamin Lincoln, appointed head of the Southern Department by George Washington, was getting help from a multinational coalition, among them the Polish, the Irish, the Haitians, and the French, led by French Count Charles-Henri d'Estaing. All told, nearly 7,000 men. And it was a fight for the soul of the city and to reclaim control of one of the most valuable parts of the South. And on October 8, 1779, the fight that had been brewing for nearly a month finally boiled over. It was time to take back the jewel of Georgia. Lincoln, D'Estaing, and their multinational force in an early morning assault attacked the Spring Hill Redoubt just outside Savannah. What unfolded was violent and chaotic. The smoke cleared and the cannons went quiet. And as D'Estaing and Lincoln took stock of what happened, they were mired in one of the most overwhelming defeats of the American Revolution. A disastrous combination of bad communication, flawed strategy, and even early morning fog had spelled epic disaster for the Patriots. And the tally was staggering. British General Augustin Prevost had lost less than 50 men, and the Allied forces, more than 1,000. Welcome to the Marked Podcast. Across Georgia, there's more than 2,000 historical markers that tell the story of a person, place, or an event from our state's past. And our digital video series explores a select few of those from Georgia's revolutionary history. And in this podcast, we're expanding on that with additional voices to help bring out the stories of these markers and the context of what they tell us about our state. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Marked the Podcast. I'm Andrew Iden, the executive producer of the Marked Project here at Georgia Public Broadcasting. And over the course of researching our state and its role in the revolution, there is a date and a battle that seemingly always comes up. The Battle of Savannah, or the Siege of Savannah, as it's commonly called, has some direct connection, it seems, to almost all of the names and people we've been talking about over the course of the Marked Project. William Jasper, who you'll learn about in our episode about the Jasper Spring, was killed during the Battle of Savannah. George Walton, who signed the Declaration of Independence, was held as a prisoner of war after falling from his horse during the First Battle of Savannah. But in October of 1779, what took place in Savannah at the Spring Hill Redoubt specifically is what really goes down in the history books is not just an impactful battle in the fight for independence, but also a very large and very costly failure. And here to talk to us about that failure is someone whose work has helped us really learn a lot about what took place that day. She is an archaeologist, a research associate, and education coordinator with the Lamar Institute in South Georgia, and in 2005... was the field director for the discovery of the Spring Hill Redoubt, which is today Battlefield Memorial Park in Savannah, the same park honoring those who died in the battle all those years ago. Rita Elliott, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Andrew. It's good to be here.
After being exiled from Georgia following his arrest and escape in February of 1776, Governor James Wright goes back to England, where he harangues minister after minister, member of parliament after member of parliament, and even the king, to initiate a southern strategy because there are strong numbers of loyalists in Georgia and in South Carolina. There was a belief among the British high command that Georgia was home to many loyalists, that it might be more easily captured, and from that capture, the British could kind of roll up the rest of the colonies, going from Georgia to South and North Carolina, and then to Virginia, and then meeting their Northern army there.
The British were in Savannah. The British occupied Savannah. They took it in 1778 very easily. So they were holding Savannah. In the fall, September of 1779, all of the colonies had no clue what was going on, from the heads of the military on down. So, you know, people were thinking, okay, just staying in the French, they're going to attack Rhode Island. No, they're going to attack New York. No, they're going to go to Jamaica. So there are all these thoughts about where they were going to attack, and nobody had a clue. And then when they started coming off the coast of Georgia, that's when everybody realized, oh, they're coming to Savannah. And that was just really caught everybody off guard, from Augustine Prevost, who was in Savannah, you know, the head of the British in Savannah, on down to everybody across the colonies, really.
Once it became clear Savannah was the target, this stopped being just a British problem, right? It became an international one. This is a global problem. Because suddenly you have Americans and French forces preparing to fight together. So can you talk to us a little bit about what that coalition actually looked like?
The French actually had a larger, more troops than the Americans. So, you know, they had about 3,000 to 4,000 troops. So Lincoln was trying to mass, you know, a likewise sizable army as well. So he's pulling troops from everywhere he could as he marched down south, just trying to get, you know, boots on the ground sort of thing. He was amassing them at different locations, near Ebenezer and at Cherokee Hill, and trying to get these groups to come on in and coalesce and right. Meet Benjamin Lincoln and meet his troops, and then surround Savannah and actually start a siege. You know, they weren't planning on attacking initially. It was just going to be a siege. They were going to put Prevost and Savannah under siege, and then they would take it in a couple of days. You know, the Prevost would give up and say, yeah, come on in. And right. Of course, it didn't work that way.
One of the things that I have found interesting in the research of this particular piece of Georgia history is that you have General Lincoln, who is leading the Patriot forces, and you have D'Estaing, who is leading the French coalition, right? And from everything that I have read and understand about these two men, it seems like they are two very different styles, I guess would be a good way of putting it. No.
Yes, definitely. They're two totally different people. And I'm sure there's been lots of good biographies written about both of them, lots of them. But basically, I think if you want to summarize it, they were very opposite. You know, Benjamin Lincoln grew up in Boston, and he was a town clerk, and then he got on the colonial legislature, and then he, you know, got into the military. But basically, he was just kind of what you see is what you get. And D'Estaing was, you know, upper echelon. He was a military man from the get-go, you know, commander of the Navy, commander of the French army. So he was, you know, used to being a very upper military person. He was rich. And so he's used to getting what he asked for or what he demanded. So they're very different. And Benjamin Lincoln, he comes across in the historical stuff sort of as a milquetoast kind of mealy mouth sort of guy. I'm not sure, you know, to his credit, he did get wounded prior to this. And there's some speculation that, you know, he wasn't the same after he got a bad wound in battle previously. But then also to give him some other credit, which I've given more credit over the years, but he right. also, he was in a delicate position because, you know, the Franco-American alliance was important. It was critical to the success of America in the colonial revolution. And if he tread wrong on his relationship with D'Estaing, that could, you know, jeopardize the entire French alliance with America. So I think he had to be very careful and very delicate.
D'Estaing is told, you can do this without any problem, really. And he wants to get it done fast. Everybody who lives down here knows September is hurricane season. He's just come from the Caribbean. He wants to get this done and get out of the way. The problem is, all of these maneuvers take time. He sends in his terms to the British and demands they surrender the city, but gives them 2 days to respond. They dig in even more. They say, nope, we're not going to surrender the city. You'll have to come and take it. He finally loses patience. And on the night of October 8th, the Friday night, he tells his American allies, led by Benjamin Lincoln, we're going in tomorrow morning.
That decision set everything in motion. But obviously, as historians have long argued, that battle was already beginning to unravel right before the first shots were actually fired. So if you can, walk us through that final night before the assault.
Okay, so they're making a council of war. D'Estaing's got all his military together, and they're coming up with this council of war. And what the first thing he does is he rearranges all the troops in the columns, all the troops, who's fighting side by side, who's next to each other, who's commanding. And that's immediately, he just totally destroys the esprit de corps. So all of a sudden you have people fighting within groups that they've never fought with before, fighting next to other groups they've never fought with. So he totally messes up the whole arrangement of the order of battle. And then doing that, he also makes it kind of pushes back the timeline as well. So they're supposed to be leaving camp, early, well, really like at 2 a.m. or so, whatever, early in the morning of October 9th. They're supposed to leave. They have to wait. The Americans are waiting on them. They're waiting on the French to come up to the American camp. And then they're all going to leave and start marching to Spring Hill. Well, they were super late because of the messing up all the arrangement of truce. And then they were late in marching and getting to the Americans. And then the guides that they hired were totally unfamiliar with the area. So they were not guiding them directly as a good a path as they could have, you know, so that slowed them down. So, you know, long story short is they were supposed to have a fake attack on the central redoubts where Madison Square is now. So those troops were supposed to attack. And when that attack began, then all the troops at Spring Hill were going to attack. So that the feint was going to kind of make the British think all the troops were going to spring the central redoubts. But right. What happened was, because everybody, all the timeline was so rearranged, the attack at the central redoubt started too soon. And also the troops didn't get to Spring Hill until well after daylight. So all of a sudden the feint is during daylight. All the troops are still amassing at Spring Hill, and the dawn has already broken. So all the British can see what's going on. It's like, hey man, they're not going to Central. They're coming up to Spring Hill, you know? Yeah. So let's gear up over here and get ready for them. And so then they could, when the Americans and the French started attacking, they thought, oh my gosh, okay, they're attacking the central redoubts already. We better get going. So they started attacking Spring Hill before all the troops were lined up and were ready to attack. People were still marching towards Spring Hill when the attack on Spring Hill began. So they didn't have all their troops in order. So the first troops that were in line went ahead and started attacking, and they were supposed to not fire until they reached the redoubt, the abattis. So they were just marching across these big expanses of open area and getting just annihilated by fire. You know, they're getting these big guns shooting at them. They're getting small arms fire. They're getting guns from the British ships in the river shooting at, you know, artillery bombarding them. So they're getting mowed down left and right. And so in the meantime, some of these other troops, French and American troops, arrived at Spring Hill. And they're kind of joining in the attack, but all of a sudden those troops get out of order, and some of those on the western side are coming out of the swamp. They're getting kind of mired down in the swamp. Then when they're trying to attack, they're getting mixed up with the column of troops next to them. And so they're all in the columns of troops on to their right are all veering towards the swamp because they're getting annihilated by this horrific fire, artillery fire and musket fire. Yeah. So it's a melee. It's a mess. Literally, it certainly is. I mean, they were, well, it's funny, one of these great quotes, there's all these wonderful primary documents. And one of the quotes is, you know, the guy is talking about, okay, the order of battle. And they said, no, I should say the disorder of battle, because it was such a wreck. I mean, from the get-go, from the planning the night before, through the starting late, to getting lost, to taking their time, or getting there to the swamp, to all the troops not amassing. It was just one debacle after the other. And it all contributed to this huge disaster on the side of the French and the Americans.
From what you understand about this disaster, can you tell me a little bit about what it must have looked like? Because, you know, we've all seen movies, right, of various wars. And as the wars go further back in time, the more barbaric they become. And the more violence, I mean, they're all violent, but like as they get old, you know, as we go backwards in time, as technology sort of devolves, I mean, the thought of what this must have looked like is just horrific.
Yeah. And I mean, not even just look, but everything, the sights, the sounds, the smells, everything. Yeah. First of all, it would have been so incredibly loud. If you can imagine, you know, these big guns, cannons going off, you know, right one after the other, musket balls firing everywhere, you know, horses getting shot out from under you, your people next to you getting shot and killed, cannonballs, you know, bouncing across the land and taking out, you know, entire parts of regiments. And then the smoke, just when you shoot these, when you shoot muskets, when you shoot the cannons, all the smoke that would be filling the air, you wouldn't be able to see very far in front of you, you know, what's going on. Just the noise, the smell was probably horrible, you know, gunpowder in the air, and you probably couldn't breathe with the smoke and the powder, and just, you know, people screaming. And then you see these Hollywood movies and you think, oh yeah, okay, so watch out, you know, the battalion on the right, y'all better watch out because there's somebody coming, you know, behind you or to the left, or there's these other people cutting you off. And you can't, back then, you know, they didn't have drones. They didn't know what was going on. If you wanted, like when, if your commanding officer got shot down, you'd have to get, you know, the next person, find the next person in command. They'd have to figure out what to do. You'd be having messages sent, you know, back to Desaing, messages going back and forth from Desaing on horseback to, you know, okay, y'all start attacking, you know, this side of Spring Hill or whatever, or messages sent to the reserve. Like Benjamin Lincoln was back at the Jewish cemetery in the reserves, and he would be sending messages forward. So, you know, the battle is happening instantly, but then it's slow-mo, you know, slow motion when you're getting these messages about what to do next, but you're having to respond in real time.
I've heard that fog played a huge role in this battle as well. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah. So that morning, under cover of darkness, Desaing and the French thought they would get the jump on the British just by virtue of the fact that they would start this whole operation while it was still dark. And that didn't happen because they came from the south. People got confused about where they were. But then that morning, it was also foggy. So the Americans and their allies all said that they were going to put white pieces of paper either on their uniforms or their hats so that you weren't shooting at each other, so you knew who was who. Eventually, as it got to be more daylight, the fog dissipated. So the British, who were behind this readout, it was like shooting fish in a barrel at that point. There was a big loss of life on the American side, but not the British. The Americans lost over 1,000. Now, some of the people who were here turned out to be quite famous. Desaing himself took 2 bullets that morning before he was finally carried off the field. Casimir Pulaski, and in a breach in the lines, he shot through on his horse and took a shot to the groin the size of an egg, a grape shot. Took him right out of the saddle, and he died about 2 or 3 days later. So there were horses out here, there was cavalry, there's infantry. You can imagine the sound of all this. There would have been men screaming, there would have been blood everywhere, there would have been people who were decapitated, arms shot off, cut off, horses that were wounded, bodies you have to step over or step on. All of that's happening at the same time. So combat is one of the most intense experiences anybody will ever experience. What it was like that morning from the vantage point where you and I are standing right now, it must have been an awesome sight. And I use that word not carelessly.
More than 2 centuries later, another search began, not for victory, but for evidence, obviously. And so your work helped uncover the battlefield itself. So talk to us about how that project actually began.
I got there in July 2005, or June, I can't remember. But anyhow, and they were already planning to make it a bicentennial park. But they didn't. They hadn't done any archaeology on that tract of land proper. My predecessor had looked in the road a little bit. But so really, to their credit, they were planning a park already. And then I got there as the first archaeologist there. And I said, well, you know, we really, if we're going to dig this up and make it a park, we really should do archaeology first. And to his credit, Scott Smith, who was the director at Coastal Heritage Society at the time, he said, well, how long will it take? And I said, well, I hope we can look at it, you know, within 3 weeks and over 3-week period. And so hadn't just gotten there. I was kind of nervous. So week one came and went. We found cool stuff. We found a early 19th century house, cellar and privies and all sorts of things. And we found week two, we found a lot of the 19th century commercial buildings that were there, the meatpacking stuff that dealt with the railroad, which is, you know, right adjacent. The roundhouse, a railroad, is right adjacent to that. And then week three was coming midway to the end of week three, we hadn't found any Revolutionary War stuff yet. I said, oh my gosh, we just moved here. I just got this job and I'm going to get fired because I'm not finding anything that I held up all this, you know, work for. And then we were looking for features, clues in the ground, stains in the ground that can really tell you what happened in the past. So we were stripping areas. And then there was this real long linear feature we found, and we kind of put off excavating it till later because there were other features cutting through it and we wanted to deal with those. And finally, towards the end, I asked one of my colleagues, Dan Elliott, who's an archaeologist, I said, can you go ahead and start excavating this one, please? Because we need to, you know, we need to wrap this up and we need to look at these other areas. So he started excavating a portion of that. And I heard this woohoo across the field and came over there and he had found a musket ball. So that was the very first. So it was really cool. So we excavated that feature. And sure enough, the stains in the soil showed us that was the bottom part of one of the defensive trenches that went around Spring Hill Redoubt. And the fill inside of the trench was all perfect. It was, you know, we found musket balls. We found a big old gun flint with the patch wrapped around it that was from a wall gun that would have been mounted on the wall of Spring Hill.
Let me ask you this before you get too much further. For the laymen's who are hearing this, are these things that you know what they are the moment you set eyes on them, or is there testing and analysis that you have to do to verify that, yes, this is in fact a musket ball or this is in fact a flint?
Well, most of them we recognize because we've excavated so many sites, similar sites in the past. Like, oh, yeah, right. This is a musket ball. Now, we do, you know, in the lab, we'll measure the size of the musket balls and the calibers can tell us what kinds of guns, if they're British or American guns, what kind of gun they went with. Gun flints, we also do, and back in the lab, do specific measurements to figure out, are they from a carbine or rifle or, you know, what size gun? So that's really helpful. But when we first see it, it's like, yeah, this is a gun flint. Yeah, these are musket balls, you know, 18th century muskets for sure. And then gun parts. And, you know, a lot of gun parts we recognize just by looking at them. Yeah, this is a prison spring from a gun.
Is that the kind of thing that, you know, if you find, and I promise I'll get you back on track with the rest of the story. But when you find something like that, is it like, oh, this is the tip of the iceberg. This is good. It's like a domino effect, right? Like you're just assuming you're going to find more and more and more.
Well, within that feature, within that stain that turned out to be the trench, we thought, yeah, you know, it'd be interesting to see how much stuff we find in it related to the revolution. But the feature itself is so important, you know, the clues it carries. So we excavated it, we cut it in half and excavated out part of it in the half that we could see in profile and side view was wonderful. You know, it was a V-shaped feature. So it was definitely a trench. And we could see when it was filled in, it was like a layer cake in the trench and then above it. So it was like looking at a history book and seeing the pages of history right in front of our face. So we could see that the trench was filled in and it was filled in just with Revolutionary War stuff. So we could see that, okay, that trench got dug. It got used in the battle. Some battle items, you know, got inside of the trench, got filled in there, washed in, dropped in, shot in, whatever. And then the rest of the trench is gone. The top, everything above, say, the first is about 2 feet, everything, a meter or something. Everything above that was gone. And what happened was it got scraped away by the railroad. But then there was another layer on top of the trench that got a deposition layer on top of that. And that's when the people were living in, you know, the house with the privy nearby in like 1801, that period. And they deposited stuff. And then that house got knocked away. And then the railroad came on top of that and put its tracks and its gravel and things like that. Well, before that was the commercial buildings, that meat slaughtering place houses and things like that, where they would do that to put on the train cars. But anyway, it's like a history book, and every deposition is a page of history or a chapter in that book.
Yeah. And I think I want to make sure I've got this right. Like, you're talking about these privies and these buildings that you found, but what you're talking about is you're finding the footprints of these buildings underground in the dig, correct?
Exactly. When archaeologists say we find buildings, that's what we mean.
No, it's totally fine. And I'm thinking, I'm like, I'm making sure, like, we're talking about the context of the footprint of the building or the house or whatever is underground. And it actually makes it so amazing that, you know what you're looking for, right? And so can you talk to me a little bit about just the feeling of finding this stuff? It's got to be an amazing, I mean, everybody stops and sort of like realizes what you found, right?
Yes, it was a big relief and then amazing too. Yeah, it's like, oh, yes, we did find it. What makes it even more amazing is, back in the 70s, the 80s, another archaeologist had come in and backhoe trenched that tract of land. I don't have it with me right now, but put in something like 20 different trenches looking for the Revolutionary War component. So actually, it helped us because we thought, okay, we know where not to look because none of his trenches found anything.
Yeah. But
then it's like, okay, is it really here or is it on another area? You know, it does. The maps back then were good, but they only had so much to tie to. You know, if you're making a map outside of a town, you don't have any landmarks that are necessarily still there, 200 years later. So they're kind of, it's like, okay, well, maybe the Spring Hill readout was like across the street on the tract across the street that we're not even looking at. So it was very, we were very excited to find it, to find some evidence that, and it still survived. It survived all the construction and the development of the years since then.
Right. And I guess, yeah, that brings me back to the beginning of this project that you started on. What was your frame of reference of understanding, okay, we've narrowed down the Spring Hill readout where all of this violence and all of this horrific stuff occurred that day during the Battle of Savannah. How did you narrow down it's within this perimeter?
Well, it's kind of the opposite. It got narrowed down for us because, we said, okay, if you're going to turn this into a park and you're going to do all this, digging utility lines and this and that and make in a, a readout, a historic readout kind of thing, then we need to do archaeology first to see if you're going to destroy the very thing you're trying to commemorate.
Sure.
So that we were restricted by the outline of the park.
How long did that dig go on?
3 weeks. So we were out there in the amount of time. We finished in the amount of time I said we would. But that was the kind of got us started. That was the stimulus for us looking at all of Savannah or more Savannah to figure out, okay, if we know Spring Hill survived all the railroad construction, all this stuff, can we find other components of the American Revolution in Savannah? So that led us to getting our first of two American Battlefield Protection Program grants to go look for other components of the Revolutionary War in Savannah.
So, as somebody who is always kind of searching for the story behind, all of these things tell a story, these things you find, right? I'm trying to kind of put myself in your shoes of when you're going through this dig and you realize what you've found, right? Which is the thing that you said you were looking for. And when you find it, it must bring that battle and what happened there into an even sharper focus.
Oh, definitely. I mean, when you pick up the artifact out of the feature where it was dropped or shot or, hit somebody or hit something and bounced off. It's like, this is the actual battle. This is where it all happened. Even though, to look around you at the landscape now, it's very hard to picture. You can go back in time and you have that, when you've discovered that object and just imagine what was going on then. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough to be looking at this, at these musket balls while you're standing, 100 yards from a courtyard hotel and thinking about, but it can just as easily kind of bring you back and like transport you, right? Like these things, you are searching for the stories. And when you find them, when you pull these artifacts out of the ground, the story comes with it.
I mean, you can go to a antique shop or get on eBay and you can buy all the musket balls you want that have been looted from sites. But so what? It's just a piece of lead. The musket balls that came from Spring Hill, that came out of the readout at Spring Hill, were part of that October 9th battle, that incredible, amazing part of our history, horrific, but very important part of our history. And you're touching that.
can you talk to me a little bit about what else you found during that 3-week dig?
Well, since we found it at the end, we started trying to follow out the trench. So we excavated more of the trench, and we really wanted to get, we found one corner of it. So it sort of angled back towards Louisville Road or the paved road. And we followed it the other way, trying to find the other corner. Unfortunately, the other corner wasn't there, wasn't where we looked, whether it's under the road or got destroyed, I'm not sure. It would have been nice to find two corners at least to get an idea on the size. It'd be nice to find all four corners, but it was going back towards under the road. Now, we did do ground penetrating radar on the Louisville Road right adjacent to it. We did that on the next ABPP project, the first grant we got, trying to find, okay, can we find evidence of the rest of Spring Hill Readout under Louisville Road? That wasn't too successful. It could have been that it went on into where the train shed building is now, and that probably destroyed some of that when they constructed that, unfortunately, years ago.
Talk to me a little bit in general terms, Georgia and its revolutionary history, as somebody who studies and literally gets their hands dirty on this stuff. What is to you the most interesting part of the Georgia revolutionary period and story?
I think what continues to amaze me is how little we know about Georgia's Revolutionary War history and how short shrift it gets in historical documents. You know, everybody thinks the revolution happened at, you know, Bunker Hill and Yorktown and, you know, maybe South Carolina, if you're going to really think about it. But Georgia was a huge part of it, too. And I don't know, you know, it got left out of the histories. And that's something we need to put back in because it was part of that important story of America. And what also strikes me in looking at a lot of these sites like Carr's Fort and different places like this, just how much of a civil war it was, you know, how much it boiled down to, you know, people hurting each other, hurting their neighbors, the politics and towns being destroyed because different, like in New Ebenezer, different political sides being in power at one time or another, and then the opposite side getting, you know, severely squashed, or out on the frontier, you know, settlers' homes being torched or people being shot because whoever's coming through is on the opposite side of whatever they're believing in. And then also just even if you survive the war, the damage it caused you, you know, you have family and friends wounded or killed or with PTSD before they even knew what that was. You had your livelihood severely damaged, you know, your chickens and your crops destroyed or pilfered by, you know, troops moving through that needed to eat. And then if you're in town, like in Savannah, your economic well-being, if you had a building, you know, most of the buildings in Savannah, like 40% of them got shot up by the, you know, the siege and the battle.
So ultimately, we know this battle for the Patriots was a failure. Talk to me about why this battle is important, not only for just the time, but the American Revolutionary period in general.
One of the things that came out of this was the tenuous nature of the French-American alliance. It hadn't worked very well here. It was still in its infancy, really. And the question was, are they going to be able to work together going forward? So that was a huge question mark. Then what's the future of the American army in the South? It did not look good. From here, Benjamin Lincoln went on and ended up surrendering the city of Charleston in May of 1780, just 6 months later. That opened up the whole nature of what's the future of these southernmost states in the future United States or in the British Empire. What's the future of the city of Savannah? The British held Savannah for the duration of the war, but ultimately it didn't really matter.
Well, that brings me to a perfect spot for my final question, sort of bookend this. In the process of all of the stories we've done, this is one of my favorite, partially because I had no file. I had no understanding of this particular date and this particular battle. And obviously that's what's great about the markers, right? The markers give us the opportunity to learn about our state and the people and what happened. And I say all that just to set up my question to you, which is, where do you think the Battle of Savannah, the Siege of Savannah, and Spring Hill specifically, Where do you think that sort of sits in the Georgia Revolutionary story? What's the important takeaway? What's the relevance? I mean, there's a lot of different ways, you know, we can look at it, but I'm just curious what your perspective is on that.
Just a monumental story. First of all, you know, you have so many different actors in it. You've got German Hessian soldiers, Scottish Highlanders, African Americans, Creek Indians, Cherokee Indians, English, Polish, Irish, French, Haitians. I mean, it's a United Nations way before its time. So it's the first kind of multinational global thing, you know, and it's huge. There's thousands of people. You think about Savannah was 2,000 people or so during the colonial period in the 1770s. All of a sudden, you've got, you know, 8,000 to 12,000 more people coming to town instantly for this siege and battle. So it'd been just an incredible story back then, but even, you know, today. And it was the first, you know, we spoke about earlier, this first time the French and Americans had boots on the ground together on the same battle. So that was the instrumental part of the agreement between the French and Americans, the alliance. So on so many levels, it was critical. And then, you know, it also, of course, set up the British to take Charleston shortly thereafter, 6 or 7 months later, they're able to swing into Charleston and take it handily. And maintain control of Savannah, you know, until they left in 1782. So it was a pivotal part of the story, not just in Georgia, but in the entire colonies.
The Battle of Savannah was a defeat for the Patriot cause, yes. But it remains one of the defining moments of the American Revolution in the South. And thanks to historians and archaeologists like Rita Elliott, we don't just know how the battle unfolded. We know where it happened, why it mattered, and why those stories are still worth uncovering nearly 250 years later. Marked, the podcast, is written and hosted by me, Andrew Iden, and produced and edited by the GPB podcast team, Jeremy Powell, Miranda Hawkins, and Mark Davenport. And Sandy Malcolm is the Senior Vice President of Content.